Baseball is back. The 2025 MLB season is upon us. So what's the easiest way to keep up with all the big stars, top scores, and fun storylines from the night before? What's the solution? Is there a secret?
Chocolate milk and squats. That's the secret.
Not quite, Pete, but there is the Morning Lineup Podcast, a quick, less than 10-minute morning highlight show from MLB. It airs Mondays through Fridays on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You bring the chocolate milk, we'll bring the baseball news.
Sabres Live, presented by Seneca Resorts and Casinos. Nothing else comes close.
We've grown by one here in the back half hour of Sabres Live. Darren Dreger has joined the mix, and he has coaching news from across the NHL. Hi, Dregs.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Yeah, news out of Anaheim, and that is that Joel Quenneville has been hired as head coach of the Anaheim Ducks. I expect if the Ducks haven't done so already, they will officially announce it in short order here. And I believe there'll be a full-on media availability later this afternoon. And now, as soon as I reported on it via X earlier this morning, appreciably, you get the backlash and you get the reconnect with the Kyle Beach allegations, the saga. The fact that Stan Bowman, you know, had to sit on the sidelines for an extended period. But now, of course, you know, he's the general manager of the Edmonton Oilers. And yet Joel Quenneville, you know, had to wait even that much longer to resurface as head coach. That doesn't matter to a part of society. You know, what I'm reading is that, you know, there's unrest as to why these men were allowed back in the first place. And so just to bring into the here and now, my understanding is that Anaheim invested a great deal of time and effort in the last couple of weeks, maybe 2-3 weeks, when they first fired Cronin. Joel Quenneville was the first candidate that they interviewed for the job of head coach. And when Pat Verbeek and company said, okay, well, look, we're interested in the experience of this guy, but we've got to do our due diligence. They went through what was described to me as an exhaustive vetting process. That, of course, dates back to Kyle Beach and everything that went in and around that. They interview people. I don't know if grilled is the right way to describe it, but they most definitely pushed Quenneville on, well, what did you know? What didn't you know that you learned after the fact? And just as importantly is, maybe most importantly, why didn't you follow up when the allegations surfaced? You know, as head coach of the then Chicago Blackhawks, why didn't you circle back to be part of finding out the truth and then dealing with it? And so whatever the takeaway was that of that was, you know, Anaheim feels that there's been enough reform work done by Joel Quenneville that he is the right man for this job. And so I'm really interested in seeing what this media availability is going to look like later today, how open and transparent and acknowledging Joel Quenneville is going to be of the mistakes that he made way back then with the Chicago Blackhawks. But as long as that process has been satisfied, then I think at least the hockey world should be able to move on and allow a very decorated coach to perhaps learn from his mistakes and, if necessary, employ the lessons learned from those mistakes in being a part of the Anaheim Ducks future and developing some of these younger players.
Yeah, that's still an unknown, right? Obviously, you never know. But do you think that being that it's Anaheim and it's not as big of a market and not big as a media kind of, you know, center, it feels like, okay, that will be allowed or acceptable. But like, I don't know that Joel Quenneville would have done Toronto or New York or Philadelphia or like Montreal or like the big market, because I think that like Mike Babcock went to Columbus. And yeah, unfortunately for Mike Babcock, he did what he used to do, and then he was shown the door before he even started. Do you think Anaheim maybe is a place where it opened the door just because it wasn't one of those big media markets?
Maybe. I mean, that sounds a little disrespectful to the market of Anaheim. Like it's not an outpost. I mean, it's one of 32 teams in the National Hockey League. I would say by volume of media, perhaps, right? Mm-hmm. You know, are you getting the news seekers that, you know, are going to constantly cover the Anaheim Ducks now that otherwise wouldn't, because Joel Quenneville is the head coach and, you know, you want to catch him, you want to, you know, hit him with this question that otherwise you wouldn't have any. I don't know. But I mean, Joel has had some expressions of interest in the past. And I look at a team like, you know, Seattle and the obvious history with Ronnie Francis, who's, you know, now the president of hockey ops with the Seattle Kraken, and Jason Botterill is the general manager. But I would think that Seattle would have had interest in Quenneville as well. But I understand what you're saying, Marty. I mean, you know, if the New York Rangers or a major center was in the market for a head coach and a guy like Mike Sullivan wasn't available and they did have some interest in Quenneville, and I'm not so sure they didn't because of the history with Chris Drury and Quenneville that dates back to the Colorado days, could it have been more complicated and louder because of just the mass of media? Yeah, to that degree, I think that there's some fairness in that.
Real quick, if you know, I mean, I don't, you don't have to be real quick because we're going to get to Sabres, but anything else new on the other coaching and GM vacancies in the NHL?
It's a tough one, man, because, you know, there are so many spots. You know, we're all still waiting to find out what Rick Tocchet's direction is. What does he want to do? You know, does he want to take time away? I'm sure, in fact, I know TNT would slot him in almost immediately if he was willing to do that. So does he want to put the pieces of his life back in place and take some time away from the game? I mean, we're going to find out, obviously. You know, Philadelphia most definitely would have interest. Of course, I look at the Pittsburgh Penguins. Someone identified the possibility of the Los Angeles Kings, right? Now, Jim Hiller is still the coach of the LA Kings, but Rob Blake and the Kings have mutually parted ways. So does a new general manager, speculation around Mark Bergevin, speculation around Kenny Holland perhaps being a fit in LA. I mean, on and on and on it goes. So that kind of stuff continues to percolate. What's interesting to me, though, is because of the number of vacancies here, you're getting a real cross-section of possibilities. You know, I've heard the Mitch Love speculation is out there en masse. Yeah. Pascal Vincent, who is with Laval in the American Hockey League. I mean, that's a guy that deserves a coaching post. You've got guys who are coaching the playoffs right now. Lane Lambert on the bench of the Toronto Maple Leafs is a name. Kirk Muller with the Washington Capitals. Glenn Gullitson with the Edmonton Oilers. And on it goes. Manny Malhotra, who's in Vancouver's system, has done a good job in Abbotsford. Could he get the Canucks head coaching job? And the answer is yes. So a lot of that stuff kind of drifting across the league right now.
Rick Tocchet will be on TNT Friday and Saturday as a guest appearance. So that is happening. And Pat Maroon will be on Monday next week. So, you know, they're rotating some people in as the playoffs go. Okay, Sabres, you mentioned all these vacancies everywhere and there's GM vacancies. So there's different candidates that maybe are looking for GM jobs. Mark Bergevin, you mentioned Kenny Holland, whatever. Here in Buffalo, Eric Staal gets hired as special, you know, assistant to the GM or special advisor to the GM. But the speculation is that they're looking for somebody else, but somebody to kind of come in underneath Kevin Adams. I don't know if that is true or not. I don't really see how that would work. Bring in somebody of experience and say, hey, you know what? You've been trying to get a GM job somewhere, but we have a under the GM kind of job as an advisor available. I don't see how that works. What do you make of all of the speculations and what's really happening here in Buffalo's front office?
Well, I mean, as of yesterday, the message that I got was that it was status quo. And as we talked about last week, I mean, of course, Kevin Adams and Terry Pegula and the brass of the Buffalo Sabres have had extensive conversations of late. And I'm sure that a lot of different scenarios were discussed. One of them, I think, was the possibility of maybe Kevin Adams taking on a different role. Again, maybe that president's role. But then what do you do? Who are you bringing in? Are you promoting somebody internally? What does that look like? All of those sorts of things. I know that Pegula and Adams are aligned. So I do think that there's value in adding a different voice like Eric Staal. Automatically, I'm wondering, okay, well, you know, because those long distance relationships kind of work, but don't, if that makes any sense. Like, yeah, I don't know. Like, is Eric going to uproot his family? Is he moving to Buffalo? I don't believe that to be the case, right? He's probably going to work from afar. And if
he'll be here in Buffalo next week, he said, for the first time. But I think from what I was listening, it's that probably what you're saying, but also
without him saying it, I'm confident in saying he is staying put in the state of hockey, Minnesota.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah.
But and at the same point, if he's the special assistant to the general manager, he has a relationship with Kevin Adams. He's not the special assistant to maybe the president. Like, Kevin Adams is remaining the general manager. That doesn't seem like it's going to change.
Agreed.
So, like, somebody coming in with experience would have to be in a lesser role than maybe what they're expected to be.
I get that. And I guess, you know, we've all heard the speculation. We've read it, you know, all that from Kenny Holland to go down the list. It feels like, you know, Pegula was adamant in going in that direction, or Kevin Adams felt like that was in the best interest of the club to go in that direction. They probably would have done that by now. Mm-hmm. No?
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like they would have done that by now. So maybe you build out hockey operations in a different way, and maybe the start is Eric Staal, and they add some other pieces. It's never a bad thing to have more voices in a process, but you've got to have somebody who can make the call, and that's going to be Kevin Adams until otherwise declared. And I don't sense that change is coming anytime soon.
Well, we have seen over the course of time many player agents switch sides and become effective, in some cases, incredible leaders of organizations, latest being the Florida Panthers, Bill Zito.
Yeah. And
this name has been out there across the league a number of times, and I read it recently, not specifically in connection with LA, but it would make more sense. Like, what is Pat Brisson's future? Is he going to remain super agent, or do you see him guiding a team someday?
Are you bugging my phone? Are you reading my text messages?
Like, been on my mind. You know how many times I have had, you know, post-show guilt for not asking this question? I feel like it's been on my tongue for months and months and months.
Yeah. Well, so automatically I'm thinking, okay, sure. It'd be nice and close to home for Pat. He resides near LA. So it does make a lot of sense. He is like a brother with Luke Robitaille.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, they've just been connected at the hip since way back when, playing together way back when. Has a real good relationship with ownership. I mean, Pat would tick a ton of boxes. And you're right. You look at the success story of Billy Zito with the Florida Panthers. I like the two-headed monster of Jeff Gorton and Ken Hughes in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Ken Hughes brought a different dynamic, the same thing that Pat would bring to any organization. So I'm not dismissing it outright, other than, and, you know, Pat's got more money than God. So I was going to say, is he willing to take a haircut to be the general manager of the Los Angeles Kings? It would make a lot more sense to me if you didn't have Marc Bergevin already within the organization, who's also a very dear friend to Pat Brisson. So Pat is like a confidant anyway, without getting paid by the Kings organization. So I'm not saying no, Duffer. I think it's valid speculation. It's a worthwhile public conversation. I wouldn't be surprised if there's actually an official conversation with Pat. But again, I look at Berge, I look at Kenny Holland, who some think is now more interested in LA, if it's possible, than he might be any other opportunity. So those are some pretty lofty names that Luke Robitaille and ownership of the LA Kings are going to have to consider.
Who would have been the original agent turned GM? Because for me, it would have been Pierre Lacroix, like the first one that I remember. But who do you guys remember, like, before that? Was there anybody?
Not before, not for me. I mean,
so
that
Pierre Lacroix, like, taking over Quebec and then Colorado.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Do some homework, Marty.
Yeah.
And then Dazzle drags when he comes back next week. Darren, you've never looked better on this show. We'll see you again next week. Oh,
you guys have a great weekend.
Sabres Live continues after this.
Baseball is back. The 2025 MLB season is upon us. So what's the easiest way to keep up with all the big stars, top scores, and fun storylines from the night before? What's the solution? Is there a secret?
Choco milk and squats. That's a secret.
Not quite, Pete, but there is the Morning Lineup Podcast, a quick, less than 10-minute morning highlight show from MLB. It airs Mondays through Fridays on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You bring the chocolate milk, we'll bring the baseball news.
All right, Paul Hamilton up next here on the Wester Hotline. Sabres made an official announcement yesterday that Eric Staal has been hired as a special assistant to the general manager. As you and I talked about, Paul, earlier this week, it's not like they're going to announce that Kevin Adams has been retained. You just kind of keep going, and that's what it appears here, right? So can we basically safely assume now that Kevin Adams will remain the general manager of the Buffalo Sabres through the into next season?
Yeah. You know, between being there for the when they were talking about the lottery and this, and yeah, absolutely he'll be back. And he's going into the last year of his contract, so okay. We'll see, you know, where this takes him.
All right, so what will Eric Staal's role be? On a day-to-day basis, what have you learned or can figure out about what Eric Staal will actually be doing as a member of the Buffalo Sabres organization?
Well, he didn't really know when he was on with Brian Duff and Marty yesterday. He basically said, you know, he's going to be here this week for meetings and he'll do whatever they ask him to do. And he basically said he's here to learn. You know, learn the ins and outs of the front office and the hockey department and what to do. And it could be anything. And he said he'll do whatever Kevin Adams, you know, asks him to do. It's almost like he sounds like an intern, you know,
yeah.
The way he's talking that. And that's not uncommon in this league, you know. I was saying earlier, it reminded me kind of Danny Briere with the Flyers,
mm-hmm.
you know, where he just, you know, came aboard, started learning the ropes. And next thing you know, he was a general manager in the American Hockey League. And then from there, he became a general manager of the Philadelphia Flyers and just, you know, learned on the fly. And there have been other NHL veterans who have done that around the league, too, that have been hired. And you know, Eric Staal, of course, has had a lot of experience in the National Hockey League with 18 years. He won a Stanley Cup. He's won a gold medal. He's very well respected around the league. And I remember even the little time he was here, and I was reminded yesterday because I had forgotten, I never met him when he was here because that was during COVID. Mm-hmm. And the only time we talked to him was by Zoom. We weren't at the arena. We weren't allowed there to cover or have interaction with players other than by Zoom. So I never actually met the man while he was here for a short time as a player.
It's not uncommon in any walk of life, especially sports. And I made this point yesterday for anybody who's upset about it, I mean, who cares? I mean, if you could be upset that they don't do more, that's fine. But bringing Eric Staal into an organization is not uncommon. And I'm going to give you another example. Dan Morgan, right? Dan Morgan was a great linebacker. After his playing career, he was hired as a scout by the Seattle Seahawks. He's now the general manager of the Carolina Panthers, right? I mean, like, this stuff happens sometimes. And if you have a relationship with somebody who wants to bring you aboard, the question is, from a day-to-day operation, my vision is, and here's the way I've interpreted it, just kind of looking at it, is this something, given what Kevin Adams said about palm trees and getting players to come here, getting a guy like Eric Staal, who has a lot of success in this league, could you see a role where he's going to be maybe the guy that talks to people around the league to tell them, hey, Buffalo's a good place to go. Trust me, I'm just about like you guys. I've been around this league, and I will tell you, this is fine, and you can come here, and you can be a part of something good. Could that be maybe what his role is?
Well, remember when Zucker re-signed, that was one of the things he said, that it's not as bad as people think it is. He goes, Buffalo isn't looked at the way some people think they are looked at around the league. So It certainly can help in that sense. That a guy like Eric Staal would come here and do that. And remember too, Anderson was hired as a scout last year. Nobody raised an eyebrow about that. I mean, he didn't have any experience as a scout or anything like that. And you saw him around Buffalo every now and then. He'd come in and talk to the goaltenders, and because they had a lot of respect for him when he played here. But he went right from his career into scouting. Ryan Miller did a little scouting, you know, right away, you know, coming in for Mike Greer. It's not uncommon for a player to come right out of playing days and do something like that. Now, you know, this is fine. I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it's a great thing. I think it's fine for what it is. He's a special assistant to the GM. It just can't be the only move,
right?
You know, for the hockey department, and I don't think it is.
Okay,
you
well, know, let's go on that, because Elliot Friedman also reported yesterday that he has heard the Sabres are going to add or looking to add a senior advisor to work with Kevin Adams, somebody who has maybe been in a GM chair before or in a big chair, is the way he put it, somebody who's been higher up, but he would still report to Kevin Adams. Is that the type of move that you think could move the needle a little bit and help Kevin Adams, or is that still falling short?
No, that's the type of move that they need. They need somebody with some experience like that and some GM experience to be able to bounce off. And so, you know, that might be one of the reasons why it's, you know, I keep hearing too that, you know, Karmanos might not be back, you know, as, you know, assistant to the general manager and the GM of the Amerks. Unlike Danny Briere, when I was talking about him, who, when he became GM of the AHL team, lived there. Karmanos doesn't, and he does a lot of things remotely, and maybe they want somebody more hands-on. And let's face it, it's not working. It's working in Rochester, I will say that. Rochester has done very well, but as far as advising Kevin Adams and, you know, what's happening, the way they're doing it, isn't working. I think there's too much agreement. I don't think a lot of people challenge Kevin Adams, because I think a lot of people on this in the hockey department don't have the experience to challenge. They don't know any better. They don't know that Kevin Adams, this decision maybe isn't a good one, or that decision is maybe not a good one. And that's what you're going to get if you bring in somebody with some experience. And you know, even before Kevin Adams was hired, I've talked about Rick Dudley, somebody of that nature, who's done the job, who's you know, very good at play, you know, recognizing players and player development and those types of things, to be able to say, guys, you know, what you've been doing here, maybe this isn't right. Maybe you might want to try something different like this, you know. And that's what they need in this hockey department.
Paul Hamilton here on the West Her Hotline. Looks like the Sabres are going to be making a few changes, some tweaks along the way. Seth Appert's name also brought up, Paul. What can you tell us about possibility that Seth Appert reportedly could have a little bit more of a hand in the hockey operations?
Well, that was brought up by a guy who also said J.J. Paterka was being, you know, shopped hard to the New York Rangers, which absolutely was false. You know, so I'll take it with a grain of salt. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's right. I am saying it makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever, which makes me wonder, you know, Seth Appert has enough problems trying to figure out Lindy Ruff's power play and coaching it. You know, I think Seth Appert did a good job with Paterka and with Kulik. You know, kind of as, you know, mentoring, because he was coaching them since they, you know, came to professional hockey. And I think he helped both those players be better last year. But I don't think I need him. What is he going to do with the hockey department? I mean, concentrate on the job you have, you know, and the coaching staff. That's enough. You don't need anything more to do. If Kevin Adams thinks he should be in the hockey department, then put him there and hire somebody else on the coaching staff. But to me, it's asinine. I don't get it at all. How he wants him to split time between the coaching staff and in the hockey, doing what? I don't get it. I'm not convinced that's accurate, but I'm also not saying it's not. It just makes no sense to me.
We'll get more on what the Sabres plan on doing with some of their RFAs. The draft is coming up a lot more here heading into the offseason. But on the ice, of course, the Stanley Cup playoffs continue. Last night, the Stars go into Winnipeg. They win 3-2. And how about the Maple Leafs? 4-3 over the Florida Panthers, Paul. This Maple Leafs team has shown really most of the, I would say second half of the year especially, but really all year, they can win tight games. This is a bit of a differently built Maple Leafs team, it feels like.
It is, but look, they're better defensively than they've ever been, I think.
And when I say built, maybe they're built mentally different, Paul. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it just feels like they're more comfortable in these situations than they have been.
Right. I think it's because they have made a concerted effort to be better defensively and are. I remember when the Sabres played them. The Sabres, they couldn't penetrate them to try to score and wound up being shut out by Stolarz, who has been injured. He didn't play that game. I think the biggest difference right now is Florida Bobrovsky. He hasn't been Bobrovsky in net. And he's been a little bit more like the Bobrovsky we all knew that was a great regular season goaltender and not a very good playoff goaltender until all of a sudden a couple years ago he was inserted into a game in their first round series and all of a sudden performed in the playoffs, something he had never done before and never lost the net. He did it right through winning the Stanley Cup last year. So he finally figured out a way to become the regular season Bobrovsky in the playoffs. But I'll tell you what, these first two games in against Toronto, he hasn't been the regular season and playoff Bobrovsky. He's been kind of the old guy, and it's hurt Florida. I mean, Florida won the Stanley Cup because he was phenomenal last year, and along with them playing well too. But they can't afford to have him not playing at the top of his game if they want to repeat.
How about Hellebuck? Another loss for the Winnipeg Jets last night. And goaltender that they got through it in the first round, but wasn't because he was his normal self, obviously, what we've seen in the regular season.
Yeah, he wasn't awful last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, the goals that were scored on him were legit goals. But How about Rantanen?
That's where I should have started. You're right. I mean, oh, my gosh.
To a point where during the regular season, I was like, what happened to this guy?
Yeah.
Can he only just play with Nate MacKinnon? And is Nate MacKinnon the reason that this guy was a superstar in Colorado? And it was, Carolina, he wasn't scoring. It didn't really go well in Dallas. And then all of a sudden the playoffs came, and he's doing things that nobody has ever done before in the Stanley Cup playoffs. I mean, he is just – back-to-back, not only four-point games, four-point periods in the playoffs. I mean, he has one in the second period of one game. Next game, he has one in the third period. And then he scores a hat trick in this game. It's mind-boggling what he's been doing.
Paul, the Utah Mammoth, what do you think about that?
I'm good.
All right.
I just didn't want it to be the hockey club.
I know, right? I know.
And I don't know. I don't understand why it took till now, why they had to be the hockey club for 1 year, but whatever. They don't care if I understand it or not. But I'm just very, very happy that it's not the hockey club. So I'm good with it.
All right, Paul. Thanks a lot, buddy. I appreciate it. Utah Mammoth. Get ready for them next year. That's their name. Thanks a lot, man. Have a great rest of your week and weekend.
Take care, Sal.
All right, you got it. Paul Hamilton right there on the Wester Hotline. And as always, Paul's appearances on WGR are brought to you by Equitable Advisors, thinking about today and planning for tomorrow. And by Relax Honda. Relax, we got this. Hey, join us in the fight against cancer by riding with Bulldog and WGR's Ride for Roswell team on Saturday, June 28th. Once you join our team, you're going to receive an email to pick up your team t-shirt and water bottle at Tom's Pro Bikes on Walden Avenue in Lancaster. Not a rider, you can still support the cause by donating to our team and helping us reach our goal of $10,000 before the ride. Visit WGR550.com for more details. All right, speaking of the Utah Mammoth, I tweeted this out yesterday. Maybe you saw it, maybe it didn't. Doesn't matter. I'm going to say it anyway. Good trivia question for you to impress all of your friends with today I'll give you all the answer to it even when we come back here before the next time after that, which is going to bring us Ryan Green from Jacksonville on Gabe Davis being released and the Jags. But good trivia question, sports trivia question for you with the answer to help you impress your friends today. Coming up next on the Northtown Automotive Extra Point Show.
Baseball is back. The 2025 MLB season is upon us. So what's the easiest way to keep up with all the big stars, top scores, and fun storylines from the night before? What's the solution? Is there a secret?
Chocolate milk and squats. That's the secret.
Not quite, Pete, but there is the Morning Lineup podcast, a quick, less than 10-minute morning highlight show from MLB. It airs Mondays through Fridays on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You bring the chocolate milk, we'll bring the baseball news.
Sal Capaccio joining us on the Western Hotline. We have some Bills chatter to get to. Jeremy and Joe, hope your Thursday is going well. Thanks for joining us, if you are. And if you're not, well, thanks anyway. You could also just still join us. I'm wishing everyone a good Thursday, including you, Sal. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Rookie camp getting started shortly. The Bills at phase two of off-season workouts, and we have a Gabe Davis conversation to have because it kind of does present itself as interesting given how available he might be if the match is there. So where do you like to start? You want to start with Gabe?
Sure. I think we can. We should. I guess maybe not super surprised, a little bit surprised, though, by the kind of overwhelming, pretty dug-in sentiment from a lot of the fan base that they wouldn't be interested, wouldn't want him. You know, I mean, it just seems like, I know he was a bit of a polarizing player in a lot of ways, not for anything off the field antics, nothing like that, but just, you know, the bad moments, some of the drops that were there. I just think there's a lot of that outweighing a lot of the good that he did for the team from the fan base. I'm not saying people are right or wrong. I'm kind of just, from an observer,
yeah,
a little bit surprised about it because he was a good player for the Bills. I mean, he was certainly a really good fourth round pick. I mean,
yeah,
you know, you take that in consideration, but independent of that, he was not worth the contract for the Bills. That was a good decision to let him go to Jacksonville for that money. Good for Gabe to get that. It was a good decision. The Bills that weren't going to bring him back at that money. It wasn't going to play that role. But man, like this is a player that you drafted, you developed. He won your Iron Bill Award 2 years in a row as the offseason's hardest worker. People can scoff at that and say it doesn't matter. I mean, I think that those kinds of things those are the kinds of players that you can seamlessly bring into your organization that fit in. Is there a question about really what role he'd be where he is? Absolutely. I get that. But as I posed to you guys, I think yesterday, as soon as you were not mm-hmm. around when this happened, Jeremy, it was the last hour of the show. And I said to Joe, and I think this is a good debate, Chopin Bulldog actually had two different answers to this when I said the same question. If I give you a choice, dollars for dollar to the same, and I know that's not the case, who's better on this team, Gabe Davis or Curtis Samuel? And I think if you say Gabe Davis or even have a debate, then there's room for this guy to at least, you could make an argument for him to go after him.
Yeah. You know, Sal, if you just, you know, do an old-fashioned pros-cons list, I think the cons are injury concerns, the cons are drops concerns, and maybe where he slots in. But the pros side of it, like you said, the Iron Bill Award. I think with Davis here, as we just entertain the possibility that could happen, he's more than a culture fit. He's a culture driver for them. Yeah. And Mitch Morse tweeting yesterday about him, like Morse played with him here and played with him in Jacksonville last year. And Morse flat out called out the Jags like, I don't get it. This guy's done everything you could ask him to do. So even though he's gone through injuries and he might not be worth that money, he would basically be free for the Bills to sign because of that offset money. So it's not even a what would you pay. It's basically if Gabe wants it, should the Bills want it?
Yeah, that's right. I don't see much of a downside, to be quite honest. Unless you feel that he's blocking someone from doing something on your team. Like, that to me would be the only downside. If you want to make that argument, go right ahead. Like, I could listen to it. But otherwise, what is the downside? That if you think that he's a terrible player, I guess. I don't think he's a terrible player. I think he had some tough moments, no doubt. I think some great moments for the Bills. I think there's a lot of that, though, that gets... you know, it's just, to me, just really kind of unfair to Gabe that in a lot of ways, the expectations that happened after the Kansas City game, right, the four touchdowns. And I even remember being on the field the following year against the Rams and it was Matthew Berry of NBC. And even he was like, yeah, Gabe Davis, you know, after last year and looking for this, you know, I think it was the fantasy football sentiment of it.
That's
from,
right.
From the people from the outside looking into the numbers.
He was one of the bigger, one of the bigger fantasy conversations about like the polarizing receiver. Is he ready for his breakout?
I mean, it was beyond that though, too. Like you're definitely right about that fantasy conversation, but I remember like even Mike Evans saying that he thought Gabe Davis was the most underrated receiver in the league and he was going to break out. So it was his peers have talked him up too.
No doubt. So I think that because of that, there were expectations that he never hit, and that was partly on him. That was partly on because of the offense they ran and a lot of different things that go into that, right? He was never that true number one guy. And look, I mean, the Bills to me, I think Joe said this. I agree with Joe with what you said yesterday about the skill set of a guy like Curtis Samuel, Elijah Moore is more needed than the skill set of Gabe Davis. Now, that said, Gabe Davis's actual, like his numbers show that he's a downfield stretcher, even though we don't think of him that way. He's not this burner. Mm-hmm. But they do need guys like that in the offense. I don't see much of a downside. And look, I think what happens a lot of times is we sit here, and you guys are doing this morning, and we all do it. It's natural, which is people are tweeting and calling, and we're talking about, well, where does he fit in on the 53? Well, wait, we're a long way from a 53, right? I mean, like, if the more people you can get to compete for the 53, the better. By the time you get to August, what if Curtis Samuel has a turf toe injury again? What if Elijah Moore twists an ankle? And if you could be sitting there going, boy, what if they would have signed Gabe Davis? Right? Like, what if he's here right now? I just think that there's nothing wrong with having competition to elevate the group.
And to take this down the road a little further, Sal, that's where it comes down to, you know, what does Davis want? Does he want a place where he's going to get targets and there's an open spot, like maybe Pittsburgh is an answer here, or maybe the Giants, or maybe New England, or maybe, you know, any number of teams, Seattle, whatever. Does he want to prove to the league, I can still play, I want to play, you know, 4 or 5 more years? Maybe he never hits 13 million again, but he's going to continue to make money and be a professional player. Or does he kind of look at it, and Tre'Davious White's not the best example here, like Trey White might not have as much time left as Davis does. Does he look at it like, I didn't want to leave, and now I have the opportunity to go back, and I'm financially fine, and I can just try and win a Super Bowl and try to make that team?
It's a good question. I will tell you that, you know, just I've gotten to know Gabe really well over his last couple of years in Buffalo, as you guys know, and he really loves Buffalo. I mean, he was just here, actually. Joe and I were looking at some pictures at the Shane Gillis concert, apparently, last Saturday night. He still has some ties here in Buffalo. He does come back once in a while. He loved this city, being in this city, being a part of this city. I know people around him loved him being in this city. All of that, all of those boxes are checked, right? Football-wise, is it the best fit for him? That's a good question. If I'm Gabe Davis and I'm looking at it, I'm probably thinking Pittsburgh might be better. Now, I will tell you, when Gabe left for Jacksonville, through that process, through the communication I had with people, I know Pittsburgh was one of the teams that was interested at the time. I don't know if they still would be. Chicago was a team interested at the time. Since then, they've done a lot of different things. They have a new coach. I don't know if that would be the case anymore. The Giants have always been kind of lurking because of Brian Daboll, Joe Shane, obviously, you know, out there. So I don't know if those teams, but I would tell you the Giants with Daboll, with their receiving group, the Steelers with what they did yesterday, football-wise, that might make way more sense for Gabe Davis. Even if he loves Buffalo, he may say, I'm not going to have the same opportunity. And I would totally understand that.
How do you see the money part of it, Sal? There's this talk about like the offset language. Remember talking about this with Russell Wilson last year that, I mean, unless some team is going to offer him more than $11 million, which I think is lunacy to think somebody would do that, then basically Davis is going to get his money. Right, so like whoever signs him can do it for the vet minimum, because anything more than that, you're just basically giving money to the Jaguars. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I have to read into it a little bit more to find out exactly all the financials on that. But I think it sounds about right. Where I guess the best way to just think of it would be you wouldn't have to.
There'd be no money
downside.
Use a ton
of salary cap space to sign him.
Right, like when you say there's no downside to it, I agree with you, and part of the reason I do is it sounds like the way his contract works and him getting, you know, released here by the Jaguars is if he did want to come back and the Bills wanted to bring him in, it feels like they can do it without ever thinking about, well, you're paying him this much, so you got to play him.
Yeah, so offset language basically is, you know, the way it works in some contracts, this happens with coaches a lot, actually. when they go to another team. Rex Ryan, I think, had offset language, which actually I think applied to his job at ESPN when he left the Bills, to be quite honest with you, from what I was told back in the day. Which is basically, if you have offset language in your contract, it's okay, you're getting this money from Team A, so if you go sign with Team B for less, it doesn't matter. The Team A is still kind of paying that salary up until that money. Anything above that, you're responsible for, but he's getting that baseline. I mean, I think, though, in the NFL, even though that's the case, you still have to account for the veteran minimum at least, right? So that would be the case here. Right. So that would be the case here. We don't see this a lot in the NFL, but it does happen sometimes. So just to poke around a little bit, if that were the case, let's just say that is the case, then again, what are we talking about? A veteran minimum type deal. I think what you said before, Jeremy, is right. The question, I think, would come down to, even if the Bills were very interested, would Gabe Davis want to do that? As much as he might like Buffalo, love Buffalo, want to, you know, he may say, it's just, I don't want to go back and, you know, rerun that. I've moved on in my career and there's other opportunities for me out there. That's very possible. But I'm a little surprised. I really am at some of the backlash from fans that say, no way, I don't want any part of that. And I think yesterday was interesting, kind of reading all of that.
Sal Capaccio on the Western Hotline as we talk about a little bit about Gabe, but also about rookie minicamp as things are going to get started. And coverage of rookie minicamp is brought to you by Fiegel Carr and Joyce, your border attorneys, brought to you in part by Window Nation, the perfect fit for your home and wallet. Bill's rookie minicamp coverage here, Sal. All right, so is it part of phase two? Like the rookie camp kind of slides under the umbrella of phase two, or is it a little different the way that it operates with rookies with regard to veterans right now that are doing voluntary stuff?
I believe rookie minicamp falls under phase three, actually,
okay,
because they get to do more. Like the phase two is for the veteran camps, for the guys that are basically able to, you know, you've passed phase one, which is just conditioning. Now you're doing a little bit more in the field. I mean, they're actually like, they'll be running like football stuff out there. They're not hitting each other, rookie minicamp, but they'll be lining up in positions. And so it's more than that. So I believe it falls under its own category of like a phase three type of camp, right?
Because they're very much allowed to work with coaches, where early on coaches and players kind of can't do stuff together, right?
Correct. Exactly right. So they'll be out there on Friday and on Saturday. We only get to watch them on Friday, and then we'll get to talk to rookies afterwards, you know, and kind of get a sense for those guys and learn about them a little bit. But yeah, that's what's going on. And then for the team itself, the rest of the team, I should say, the first 2 weeks they were in phase one. Now the next few weeks they're in phase two, which I believe started earlier this week. And again, that's now you're starting to be able to do a little bit more with footballs, with actual coaches, stuff like that. And then obviously this will dovetail towards the end of the month into OTAs, what they're going to officially call them. And then mandatory mini camp for 3 days in June, which is a lot more obviously football stuff and, you know, guys that need to be here. Right now it's still voluntary.
And on rookie minicamp, Sal, some of the thinking about, you know, some of the players that will be there, the draft picks specifically, how do you think about this is kind of like the beginning of the ramping up for these guys in the building, especially like how important it is for the draft picks at the end, you know, like the sixth and seventh mm-hmm. round picks. Every year the Bills end up releasing one or two just because that's the roster. It's a deep roster and it's tough to make it. And whether it's Dorian Strong, Chase Lund, Caden Prather, like, this is kind of the start of, I don't want to say it's an uphill climb, but it's definitely going to be tough to make the roster at positions that are pretty deep.
I would say it this way, Joe. I don't think anyone doesn't make the team, but people could make the team. Meaning, this wouldn't be draft picks. This would be guys like on rookie tryout basis, like Joe Andreessen. Like, remember, this is where they found Joe Andreessen last year. They went to rookie minicamp. They gave him an invite. You're going to get guys who are not under contract who are at rookie minicamp. So when we get out there tomorrow will be the day. There's going to be a little card given to all the media. Here's the rookie minicamp roster. There's going to be a bunch of names on there people don't recognize. There's going to be undrafted free agents. Maybe you've read about them. And then there's going to be tryout players. You're like, oh, this guy, he's trying out. And he's from Erie, PA. He's from Syracuse. He's from Buffalo. He's a local guy. Oh, this guy, yeah, he played, you know, for a year in the CFL or whatever. You know, there's certain rules about how much you can have experience to be a part of this whole thing. They have four quarterbacks on their regular roster right now. None of them are eligible for rookie minicamp. You know what that means? Someone's coming in to throw the ball. Mm. So, like, they're going to have someone on a rookie minicamp tryout to play quarterback. And, look, that guy's probably not going to make the team. But who knows what happens when you get here and they go, hey, you know what? Really, really like a certain person, whatever position that is. Now, as far as the drafted guys are concerned, Yeah, I mean, this is more of a, hey, we need to get you in here. We need to kind of get you acclimated. They're not making the team or not making the team based on what happens this weekend. This is really just more of an acclimation period for everybody. But it is an important period for guys, like I said, who, look, they only have 89 on the roster right now. They are allowed 91 because Travis Clayton is still considered an international guy. So there are two spots left if the Bills feel someone wows them and they can sign them to a deal like they did Andreessen last year.
Sal Capaccio on the Western Hotline previewing Bills rookie minicamp. Great moments in rookie minicamp history, Sal. I mean, my biggest one is Jason Peters catching a pass from J.P. Lossman. But, you know, what do we really find out about these guys? Or is it really about how these players start to find out what life is like with the Bills?
Yeah, I think that's the case, right? I mean, I could tell you, I have a couple. Now, I wouldn't say great moments, but things do stand out. Like, the two guys that I remember specifically that were, to me, okay, like, wow, he's... Sammy Watkins, like when I remember seeing him for the first time, like, okay, he's just different, right? Like, he's a little different. And the other guy actually stands out for this was Ron Darby. I thought Ron Darby, like, when he you could see he was just a better athlete than all the other guys out there.
Yeah.
The first time I saw him at rookie minicamp, I remember thinking that about him. I think Tre'Davious, Josh Reed and I think he'll share this story too at some if you talk to him, because I remember him sharing it and I said, yeah, that did happen. We were standing next to each other when Tre'Davious was out in the field. And I think something like when the ball was like going to his hands, you could kind of feel it. You could hear it. It's kind of smoother. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't, he wasn't fighting it. You could remark and you could tell that. Then you just have the guys that are just bigger guys and you say, whoa, that guy's looking at him in his shorts and in his helmet, standing there. So those kinds of things do happen. You know, it's a chance for these guys to get here, and not only on the field, guys. Let's remember, this is also the weekend.
The bus tour?
In some capacity, they're going to kind of learn Buffalo. They're going to be taken out on tours.
All right.
They're going to be taken around town. They're going to go to the Niagara Falls. We used to do that, and the media was a part of it, where we'd go and kind of film it and, you know, talk to these guys. That's not the case anymore. The Bills' own media might have some stuff on that and social, but they'll kind of be touring Western New York a little bit in some capacity, I'm sure. That's what they usually do.
Very good.
Are you jealous, Sal, that the Rams are having their mini camp in Maui?
Maui camp is what they call it. Maui camp.
Put a word in to make Dermot, see if you can move it to Hawaii next year.
Interesting, right? And then next year they're going to Australia, Rams.
Yep. For a game.
We were just talking about that actually in the last segment about, you know, not to say the Bills will play in that game. Did you look up there? They don't even play the Rams next year?
I don't think they do.
Okay, but either way.
They could.
Yeah, the common finisher could line up.
But we were talking about like what time that game would be at because of the difference and like... If you put it on at 9 in the morning, that's midnight at Australian time. Or if you want it at some reasonable time, Australian time, it'll be in the middle of the night here. So that's not this year's schedule debate, though. That'll be next year. But
well, Joe, is this the part where I say you should listen to our Always Game Day and podcast,
the
Buffalo podcast, we talked about this? We literally talked about this and asked him, but your point is right. Actually, and what you said is exactly what he said, which is you got to figure that out.
Yep.
Because of the time differences, like, where do you want to slot that game? My thought is, I think what they might do, and I don't know this for sure, I think what they might do is play that game on the Saturday before the season starts, right? So you have the Thursday game for the opener for the championship, the Super Bowl winner. You have that Friday international game, right, that we've been, that's had.
Yep.
And then maybe you play that one on Saturday, and you do it because if you do it in at a time where it's a Saturday night and it's a... What's Sunday there, right?
I was going to say, Sunday in Australia, but Saturday night here.
Right, you do that, then you actually give those teams a little extra time to get back and get ready for the next week. And what you could do is, you could take the teams that play in that game and put them on a doubleheader Monday night the following week to give them an extra day.
Right, all right. Interesting.
That's good.
Let's get a call in quickly with Sal before the break. Brad in East Aurora. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hey, guys. I would absolutely love to see Gabe Davis back on the Bills. I think at the very least, he'd be an upgrade from Mac Hollins, the guy who was on the field all the time last year. And I know that Gabe absolutely embodies what it means to be a Buffalo Bill, and I'd love to see him back. I think his downfall really was that huge game against the Chiefs, a 4-touchdown game, and everybody expected him to be that, and he wasn't. But I'd love to see him back on the Bills. I think he'd be an excellent addition.
Thanks, Brad. You know, Sal, one thing, you know, I'll just mention this as another potential feather in Gabe's cap. If it were to, if the pairing were to reunite, which who knows? Again, like I really feel like it's almost more up to Gabe. Has anybody ever had better downfield chemistry with Allen than him? Isn't he number one in terms of getting behind defenses? Like he's the guy that was able to do that, obviously, in that game, but also in other spots, too. Like, we got the 98-yard touchdown against Pittsburgh. He went over the top of teams a bunch of times. And, you know, I know the Bills talk about wanting that, and maybe they get that from the slot with Elijah Moore and maybe Josh Palmer as well. But it's just, to me, it's worth pointing out that chemistry, it was pretty consistent.
I agree. His numbers, his downfield numbers were good. Average depth of target, I think he kind of led the league or was near the top of the league in several years with the Buffalo Bills. But you're right. And we don't think of Gabe as this burner, but he's always been a guy that was able to get down the field and make plays down the field. And you're right, with Josh Allen, they had good chemistry. Unfortunately, didn't have that chemistry in that Eagles game, right? I mean, that was the one, well, that's one play that stands out for the negative that people point to and look at. There were a couple others, right? There's a couple drops along the way, and I understand that. And if that's what people are pointing to, why they wouldn't, you know, welcome him back, then yeah, I get it. Like, I understand that. I just think that there's a lot of good as well that, you know, he has been a part of.
Yeah, that's a good point too. I hadn't thought of, like, him at the, or thought even at the end, was when Joe Brady takes over as offensive coordinator. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much this has to matter, but I mean, there were a ton of games where he just wasn't involved at all. Like, of the games Brady was the offensive coordinator, he had four games without a catch. But you also did have two games in there where he went over 100. So remember that at the end, it was kind of back or forth. Like, he wasn't at all involved. And then even that Eagle game that you referenced where him and Allen are off in, that might have been in overtime, where we thought they had a touchdown. Like, Gabe went for six catches, 105 yards, and a touchdown in that game.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, he leaves at the same time as Stephon Diggs. Mm-hmm. And Diggs was clearly the number one. And then they go to the everybody eats mentality and mantra, right? And that's not Gabe. He's not a part of that. And you wonder if he's a part of that, is it any different for him? So,
right.
Yeah, it's interesting to monitor and see where this goes. You know, I wouldn't rule it out for the Buffalo Bills. Never rule something like that out. Look, they just did. They just went out and brought back Tre'Davious White and Dane Jackson. This is not Joe had the list, you know, a couple weeks ago. The guys this happens to. But I do think that, you know, if you're Gabe Davis, I think you have to look at the football landscape and decide also, like, what is your best opportunity and chance here?
Thank you, Sal.
You got it, guys.
Sal,
by the way, hey, real quick, you guys got me?
Yeah.
We're gonna have Ryan Green on from Jacksonville today.
Very good.
Good radio host down there. And he'll kind of fill in maybe some of the gaps of why this has been, you know, why Gabe was released basically by the Jaguars. So we'll have him on today.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Sal.
You got it.
Sal covering Bill's rookie minicamp on WGR. It's presented by Fiegel, Carr, and Joyce, your border attorneys, and brought to you in part by Window Nation, the perfect fit for your home and wallet.
I want to remind Bills fans, too, that coming up in less than a week, Wednesday, May 14th, come out, meet Greg Rousseau, 4 to 5 at the Quaker Crossing Verizon store. That's 3500 Amelia Drive in Orchard Park. And while you're there, you can enter for a chance to win a Buffalo Bills experience that will include tickets to the home opener, post-game field access, and a $250 gift card to the stadium store, courtesy of Verizon.
And that day, you'll find out what the home opener is. Wednesday, May 14th.
On May 14th,
May 14th, that's when we find, if not before then, but the home opener.
Come celebrate what it'll be with Greg Rousseau.
There you go.
On the field.
803-0550 on retired numbers. I have an interesting thing here that happened. A team gave away a number that everyone listening thinks should probably be retired by that franchise. They gave it away to a draft pick already. Tell you who that is, and Connor Orr from SI on a solution to the retired number problem as well.
Baseball is back. The 2025 MLB season is upon us. So what's the easiest way to keep up with all the big stars, top scores, and fun storylines from the night before? What's the solution? Is there a secret?
Chocolate milk and squats. That's the secret.
Not quite, Pete, but there is the Morning Lineup podcast, a quick, less than 10-minute morning highlight show from MLB. It airs Mondays through Fridays on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You bring the chocolate milk, we'll bring the baseball news.
This is One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health.
All right, hour number two on a very busy Monday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you, and pleased to welcome in now to talk a little bit of the offseason overall and the draft class more specifically. Pro Football Focus NFL draft analyst Trevor Sikkema joining us, friend of the show. And Trevor, thanks for giving us some time. We are a little bit removed from the draft now, but certainly plenty of time to still discuss this. You gave the Bills an A-minus grade, and I actually asked Brandon this himself because I can't remember a draft class that lined up as well as this one did with some of the most pressing positional needs that the Bills had in the Bean McDermott era. And I asked him, can you remember a draft class that worked that well for him before? And he said he could not. So I know with your grade, you probably feel similarly.
Yeah, and the two, I think, major areas that they were looking to improve when it came to the 2025 NFL draft was secondary, right? Getting a guy who could be a competent starting outside corner for you. And then really a lot of just work on the defensive line, getting a little bit younger, getting a little bit bigger. And I think that they did that across the board, right? It started with Maxwell Harrison. And I think that when we went through mock drafts for the Buffalo Bills, when we got to their pick at the end of the first round, it was often, okay, did the right corner fall to them at the back end of the first round, or are they taking a pass rusher, an interior defensive lineman? And it felt as though once we started to get close towards the draft and we went a little bit further beyond those round one mock drafts, we would start getting into, okay, what's a two-round, three-round mock draft look like for the Bills or whoever we were doing it for? When you built out the draft strategy, it was almost like you couldn't lose, right? This draft class was just, it was set up in the right way to allow Buffalo to navigate this thing how they wanted. And it was really just a matter of picking the players that they wanted there. And so I think certainly with their first handful of selections before we got into day three, in the middle of the day three specifically, they were hitting those two areas hard. And I thought they got a lot of really good players. I do.
Yeah. And it really came about, we had seen so many mock drafts that, and you know, they're all over the map sometimes, particularly early on, because everybody kind of hones in after free agency. Then you can kind of focus in and you kind of get a better idea. But all three of the Bills' first three picks at one point were mocked in the first round to Buffalo. I thought that, and particularly Landon Jackson. I thought all of these picks had a chance to be there. But man, oh man, if you'd have told us maybe in March that all three of those guys would be available for the first three picks of Buffalo, I don't think you would. I think most people would have said they've been gone.
Yeah, I'd agree with you 100%. I think that Jackson was the most surprising that he was there at number 72. He is somebody who I had him ranked 39th on my big board. And funny enough, when you look at Maxwell Harrison and TJ Sanders, I actually had Landon Jackson ranked highest on my big board out of those three guys. Now, that's not to take anything away from the first two. I had Jackson 39th on my big board. I had Harrison 43rd, and I had TJ Sanders at 54th. And so it's right around the same value. But to get all of these guys in a single haul, I think, is what makes this really impressive. Now, clearly, I was a little bit lower on Harrison than I think just other people were in general. Like, I had Benjamin Morris in the corner from Notre Dame a little bit higher. Trey Amos, who ended up going to the Washington Commanders. Those are two corners that I had above Maxwell. But for Buffalo specifically, they like to play that off-zone coverage type of defense. A lot of cover three, a lot of quarter stuff. And with that, that leans into what Maxwell Harrison does really well. So I wondered if he would be somebody that they considered in the second round. They obviously thought highly enough of him to take him in the first round there. But yeah, I agree with you. When you just look at this draft class as a whole, it's hard to not give the Bills anything less than, I would say, a B at worst, just depending on if you had certain players that you would have rather had them selected certain positions. But a really job well done by them and their scouts.
And then in terms of the moves that Brandon Bean made up the board, he did it twice for defensive tackles. Goes up 15 spots to get Sanders, goes up 23 spots on day three, right out of the gate, to go get Deion Walker. And it's an interesting case study here with Deion Walker because they did a really deep dive into his background. Obviously, they came to understand that he played with a pars defect in his back all senior year. And so when they compared and contrasted his 2023 tape with his 2024 tape, and after talking to him through the pre-draft process, I really feel like they felt they had a firm grasp of why we saw the production fall off the way it did. The sense we get is they attributed a lot of it to his injury and not being able to play with leverage because his back hurt.
Right.
And Bean has said it. He basically said if he came out in the 24 draft, he would have been a first-round draft choice. He's convinced of it. That's just his opinion. And he's still a risk because of what 2024 was on paper and on film. What level of boom could you attach to a player the caliber of Deion Walker if he returns to 2023 form?
Yeah, I think that he's a starting caliber NFL player, right? If you look at 2023 and you say to yourself, not even returning to 2023 form, but you remember, like, you know, he's an underclassman at that point as well. And so, like, this is still a young football player. So if you go back to 2023 being a baseline and assume that he is going to get better, well, now obviously you have something that is worthy of maybe not a first, maybe it would be a first round pick, but just something top 50, first two rounds, whatever it is. That's the range that you take a player who has starting caliber NFL ability. Now, this is one where I sort of have to trust the NFL team that took him, right? But I sort of have to trust Brandon Bean and the work that they did to get to the bottom of it and do that background information. Because on my side of things, I don't get to talk with him. I don't get the extensive medical backgrounds. I don't get to talk to the school and things like that. And so instead, all I can really see is, hey, he was great in 2023, but then obviously, okay, we take the back injury into account for sure, but you guys mentioned it. This is a uniquely built prospect, really long, really tall, has massive size to him. But when you don't play with good pad level, it makes it hard to just succeed at the NFL level, even for as big as he is. And so in 2024, that leverage game just got away so far away from him where he was not able to be explosive. He was not able to be a difference maker. And if you don't think that that 2024 film is a representation of who he is as a prospect, then I can understand leaning on more of 2023 and the potential that he had there. I was very wary on it just because I didn't really know what to believe. I had heard of the back injury, obviously, when that became public. But still, the 2024 tape was not nearly as impactful as you needed it to be and consistent as you needed it to be. But to answer your question, you know, what could this guy become? What is the boom of the boom or bust scale here for him? I think he is a uniquely built potential impact starter along their defensive line, especially when you throw a guy who's already got great length to him and versatility like Greg Rousseau. Obviously, the more length and the more size that you have, it only frees up a guy like Ed Oliver to do his thing as a one-gap penetrating and attacking defensive tackle. I think the same for TJ Sanders as well. Both of those guys are sort of cut from the same cloth. And so if Walker can get back to 2023 form, at the very least, in my opinion, he's a rotational player that could be an impact guy for you that just gives you that unique length that can make him a mismatch against a lot of interior offensive linemen, even in the league.
And as you get down further into the draft, the Bills go to Ohio State and take Jordan Hancock. And for a lot of people, he's just, well, he's a middle-round defensive back. And you look at him and you look at the Bills roster, Taron Johnson has been an absolute difference maker for this defense. And because of his ability to play slot corner all the time on first and second down as well as third down. Jordan Hancock seems to me the same guy. So when you get into that part of the draft and you're looking for some, maybe not a starter, but a guy who could step in and do what your top guy does, it seems like Jordan Hancock fits that bill.
Yeah, 100%. And I like, I like him going to this defense specifically because I like how they have used their defensive backs as, okay, are they corners slash slot defenders? Are they safety slash slot defenders? Hancock is more of that safety slash slot defender player, but that just means that he brings you that plus size. He's got great length to him as well. I think he's got a long wingspan. He's got those long arms for pass breakups, for wrapping up tackles. You can match him one-on-one against tight ends. I feel like he got very confident as a slot defender. I didn't love his 2023 tape, and honestly, getting back around to his 2024 stuff, it took me a while to get to his final eval, but when I watched him, I was like, man, I think this guy could be a starting slot player in the NFL. And so again, for this defense, a good scheme fit as well as a talent fit. He can come down from depth. He could tackle you with some pretty good hitting power as well. So I think he's built like an NFL slot. He can neutralize a lot of different types of defenders, and I think that reliability as a tackler is what makes you feel so good about Jordan Hancock there. But I also like this selection too.
Yeah, a lot of people surprisingly like the Dorian Strong pick out of Virginia Tech as well. Press man guy, and while he might not blow up the stopwatch, there are people that are saying they're getting Christian Benford vibes from Dorian Strong, who, as you know, was a sixth-round pick.
Yeah, I won't say Benford quite yet, just out of respect for how good Benford is, yeah, honestly. Right. But I do think that certainly Dorian Strong, again, I like him as a fit in this defense. And whether it is in press man or I also like what he can do as a zone coverage defender as well. I think he's got good instincts to him. He's got those long arms now. He's got a little bit of a slender build to him. And so you want him to get a little bit stronger. You want him to be a little bit more reliable when it comes to making a difference at the catch point or wrapping guys up for tackles. But he is somebody who I just love the instincts. When I watched him play, it felt like, okay, he's got a good feel for when wide receivers are going to break in their routes. You know, he understands how to not just play. When we say play press man coverage, a lot of times we just think, oh, okay, this guy's big, he's long, and he's strong. That means he can play press man coverage. When you play press man coverage, you've got to understand what a wide receiver is about to do. You've got to understand different packages of releases, quick releases, more elongated releases. You've got to understand, okay, when you can anticipate the breaks in the route, because you're often, you have your back to the football when you're playing in press man coverage. And so it takes a lot of instincts to play that type of coverage as well. So I think that he's got that to him. And then that shows up in the off coverage work as well. He has the appropriate amount of space between him and the wide receiver to sort of make a quarterback make a second guess a throw, you know, just pump fake one extra time to give the defense an advantage to close in on him. I think that Strong is that kind of a player. So the reason why he dropped to where he did is because there's a little bit of play strength concerns with him. But if he can get a little bit stronger, I really do think that you have got a good depth piece type of a corner and somebody that might be able to fill in for you as a starter at some point.
Let's go back up to the just after the top of the draft. Everybody we've been talking about, my co-host here as well, have landed on this Landon Jackson guy who, hey, I like him too, but everybody we talk to is just gushing over the fact that the Bills got him where they got him. What are your thoughts about him and how big a contributor? And I get it. You pick him in, you know, the second round or mid at the back of the round or early in the third, whatever it was, 72, I think.
Yeah, early third.
You know, how much can you expect out of him? And could you get a guy that outplays that?
I think so, absolutely. To me, when I look at Landon Jackson, this is a new bet and an even higher athletic ceiling than what you had when they took AJ Epenesa. I really do think that because the baseline is the same. Okay, this is a uniquely built defensive end prospect. He's got the long arms. He's got the long build. A lot of that was the strengths of what AJ Epenesa was sort of bringing to the defensive line. But I think that Landon Jackson's got a better first step. I think he's a little bit more flexible, and obviously you're getting him now on a cost-controlled rookie contract. So this is somebody who I had the chance to interview Landon Jackson for a feature piece we did over at PFF as well. Just a great dude. I mean, just absolutely loves football, comes from a football family. He's going to work his butt off for you, and I think that everybody at Arkansas said the same, honestly. And he was a pretty high recruit when he got to LSU, and he's just dealt with some knee injuries early on in his career. But, you know, he's been saying over the last 2 years he's good to go now, and I think his tape definitely reflects that. He had his highest PFF grades of his career this past season, an 83.5 overall grade. He's got some pretty strong run defense scores, but then you get those flashes of a pass rusher as well. So again, this is somebody who is that similar mold of why you would draft and be drawn to a player like AJ Epenesa. But I even think that Landon Jackson's got a higher ceiling than that, and you're simply resetting that type of player on your defensive line with a guy that you got a rookie contract on in the third round.
All right, so help me here, Trevor, with an overarching look because, you know, they come out of this draft. They have one receiver as a seventh-round pick in Caden Prather out of Maryland. And then on the heels of the draft, they sign Elijah Moore, who just put pen to paper today and is now on the roster. So you couple that with Josh Palmer in the ad there, Laviska Shenault, who's probably going to be primarily a special teams guy. What do you think about what they have added collectively at receiver? They're younger, I would argue a little bit more athletic too, and some more speed on top of that. But collectively, if you can compare and contrast this year, at least what the receiver core looks like right now on paper compared to what they had last year, you know, knowing Mac Hollins is out the door among others.
Yeah, I mean, losing Mac is big just because he's such a clutch performer for you, and obviously, you know, losing Amari as well. Like that's any time that you're doing that and you're replacing those players, like it's tough. You know, there's going to be a lot of in and outs in the lineup, but your hope, obviously, Khalil Shakir, mainstay for you. You're hoping the tight end room continues to be reliable, maybe even more reliable and impactful than it was the previous season. You're certainly hoping that Keon Coleman is taking another step up in his second year as well. I like the add of Palmer because when you're losing Matt Collins, the big thing that you're losing is that vertical ability, right? Some of those big catches deep down in the field. And I think that Palmer allows you to do that. There were times when I liked Prather better than his teammate who went in the third round, Ty Felton. I'm going to be honest with you. And so there are times when I felt like Caden Prather looked more like the future pro than Felton did. So I felt like I was a little bit higher on Caden Prather than other people were out there. But I think the group is totally fine. I think especially adding a guy like Elijah Moore, okay, taking a chance on him, LaVisca Chenault, letting him be a special teamer. Like, I just, the room is pretty deep. You've got a lot of names that are there. Is it the most star-studded group? No, but very clearly, this team was very good at scoring last year. They were one of the top scoring offenses in the NFL, and I think that they have done enough to remain in that top portion of the category. And so I saw that Brandon Bean was talking about this a little bit earlier. Like, hey, defense was our focus this year. Like, we feel as though what we have built around Josh, how the offensive line played last year, like we know we can score points, and I still think they can score points with the wide receiver group that they have. And here's the other thing to remember: acquiring wide receiver talent, you get the opportunity to do that all the time, whether it's in the draft or whether it's in the pro market. You have the opportunity to get wide receivers all the time, every single year. And so let's say that even the group that they have right now, they want to upgrade a little bit more at receiver. They will be able to do that at the deadline. And if it's a little further than that, they will be able to do it in free agency. And then if it's further than that, they will be able to do that in next year's NFL draft. And so I know that like fans love wide receivers. Like everybody wants to have like the great wide receivers. And obviously it's a big part of why your team is so successful. But I try to remind people that in the capitalism game of supply and demand, there is a heavy supply of good wide receivers that can break out for you and be impactful for you. And so I like the way that Buffalo went about this offseason, prioritizing the defensive side of the football, getting different wide receivers in there, but I still think that that's enough for them to be a high-scoring offense in 2025.
I know this too. We're just got over with a 2025 draft, and I get it, and it's all the way too early projections. But put yourself down the road 3 or 4 years. What are you going to remember about this year's NFL draft?
Man, honestly, the very first thing that came to my mind is like, what a host city that Green Bay was actually. You know, like I know that there's somebody's like, oh, you know, not every team or not every city should be able to host a Super Bowl. Like you got to have certain stipulations. And so we should rotate the draft around everywhere. And man, what an incredible scene that was. I mean, when they get up there and they were saying, oh, like, it, you know, for the first time since 2002, the Green Bay Packers select wide receiver, and the crowd's kind of going crazy. And then they say Matthew Golden, and the crowd just erupts and goes nuts. I mean, the scenes from there were unbelievable. The NFL draft has turned into such a cool part of the calendar. I've obviously been somebody who's been a huge NFL draft fan for a long, long time, but to see the league evolve this event and just like see the sights and sounds of what was from Green Bay this past year, it was really cool. And I think it showcases that, man, if you put the draft in one of these passionate fan base locations, you're absolutely going to love it. And it's going to be an incredible weekend.
Yeah. I mean, that was the moment of night one by far. I can't even imagine what it was like for Matthew Golden. I mean, this is your moment, you know, probably the best moment of your young life, unless, you know, you got a family and kids. And he not only gets picked in the first round, but by the team that's hosting the draft, and there's 100,000 people that instantly love you after they just heard your name got called. I cannot imagine what that was like, just walking out, and there's a sea of humanity, and in that moment, they all love you. I don't know if it's going to get better than that for him.
I don't know. Everything's downhill from there, isn't it? It kind of has to be. I mean, that's not just like walking out of the tunnel getting introduced.
That's unbelievable.
Either. That's like, wow. That's a moment. That's awesome.
It's a lot of pressure, but I agree with you guys. I mean, like, he will never. I really hope that he has the kind of career where he can look back on that moment fondly, because that's something that was truly special.
That's absolutely unbelievable. Trevor, thanks as always for the insight. We appreciate it. We'll catch up with you down the line. Enjoy a little downtime here that the draft is over and you can kind of breathe a little bit.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Anytime.
All right. That's Trevor Sikkema, Pro Football Focus NFL draft analyst, joining us. Gave the Bills an A- on their 2025 NFL draft class, and his favorite pick was Landon Jackson, Steve.
I know. Just another one on the
list.
Let
the hype train get rolling.
I'm almost getting a bad taste in my mouth for how many people are loving Landon Jackson.
Not that
I have anything against Landon, but I'm like, yeah, okay. Because I remember hearing his name before the draft, but I don't remember hearing it like this.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
We will see. The pride of Texarkana.
Yes.
So I found out that Texarkana is in Texas. This is something that I have learned.
Yeah. Okay.
You
went up and looked at it.
Well, I would have guessed one of the three states, but I probably would have guessed Arkansas first, but...
Mm-hmm.
Texarkana, Texas. It was funny. So we were talking to Brandon about this, and being from Texarkana, which is middle of nowhere, they were trying to fly him up along with TJ Sanders, the two day two draft picks. And they were going to try to have him here for the media on Saturday for day three, you know, kind of like with Max Harrison, gets picked on Thursday night, here Friday to meet the media. They were going to do the same thing with TJ and with Landon. Well, TJ, they had no problem getting here because I think he was in Columbia, South Carolina. So they got him up here, no problem. It was a little bit more challenging.
Did he drive to Little Rock or what?
Well, he never made it because he would have had to drive to Shreveport, which was the nearest airport. That's the nearest airport.
Louisiana?
To where he lives. Drive him to Shreveport, and then he was going to have to fly somewhere else, get a connection, and then get... So between the drive and the connections,
yeah, no shot.
It was going to take him 11 hours to get here and for a four-hour visit.
Yeah.
And then you're going to put him back on a plane, another... They're like, we'll see you at rookie minicamp. Like, we're not going to do that to you.
Yeah, I just hope that it's not because he lasted until pick 72 that everybody loves him. I wish...
Well,
you know,
he is...
Whether he was taken at 30 or 41 or 72, I hope that's not the... I just hope the guy can play.
Right.
For your sake, because if he can't, you're going to hear about it, Bruce Lee.
Okay, that's fine.
But
you heard Trevor say on his big board, he had him 39th.
Right.
And he went 72 overall.
That's the thing.
That is part of the reason I'm excited, because I think he is a value, probably their best value pick. Obviously, if Deion Walker plays like a first rounder, he'll be the ultimate value pick in this draft.
Of course.
But still in all, I think it is because of the value that he represented. A lot of people had him as an early second-round selection. He goes early third round, a full round later.
Like I said, Maxwell Harrison, TJ Sanders, and Landon Jackson were all mocked to the Bills at 30 at one point in the offseason in the run-up.
And Trevor echoed the same sentiment. I mean, he had Harrison, Sanders, and Jackson all within like 12 spots of one another on his big board.
Right.
You got all three in your first three picks. I mean, that's a pretty rare opportunity that you capitalized upon. So hopefully it pays just as big a dividends on the field. Because as we know, the proof is in the pudding.
Yep.
Got to take a break here. Steve and I back with more in just a moment here on One Bills Live, presented by Collider Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Baseball is back. The 2025 MLB season is upon us. So what's the easiest way to keep up with all the big stars, top scores, and fun storylines from the night before? What's the solution? Is there a secret?
Chocolate milk and squats. That's the secret.
Not quite, Pete, but there is the Morning Lineup podcast, a quick, less than 10-minute morning highlight show from MLB. It airs Mondays through Fridays on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You bring the chocolate milk, we'll bring the baseball news.
If the Florida crowd is at all subdued as that series arrives. Not tonight. They played in Toronto last night. But
yeah. See, I think it's the only game tomorrow night.
Leafs up 2-0 on the Panthers. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog here, joined now on the Western Hotline by ESPN's Greg Wyshynski. We've enjoyed Greg's visits many times over the years. Especially I'm grateful when it's during the playoffs like this. ESPN has the doubleheader tonight. And Greg, let me say first, really, Bulldog should be the one to say it. He enjoyed your work on the broadcast last night.
on ESPN Bet Live, you mean?
No, on the intermission show.
With the parade.
Oh no, dude, that's my buddy Ardo. We look the same. We both look.
Dude,
like,
are you kidding me?
The incredible president. Yeah. No,
Oh my god.
You could always tell because he's the one putting over Toronto, and I could care less about Canada.
That's right.
That makes a lot of sense. I feel like such a donkey now. I went to your Twitter feed and looked and saw the picture that you had posted. I'm like, oh yeah, of course that's you.
Do you guys think they'd let me within 20 feet of the adult table?
Well, that's why I was so impressed. I'm like, yes. Oh, we're talking to Greg. I was watching with my son. He thought it was you, too. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's Greg Wyszynski. We're talking to him tomorrow. Cool. Man, I feel like such a jerk. I'm sorry.
Sorry, everyone.
Yeah. Well, Greg, nice talking to you.
Why does Greg care if there's a parade in Toronto?
I know, right? I thought you were just trolling Canada, and I could get behind that.
It's a good bit.
Yeah.
It's a good bit. I mean, I've been doing the bit on social media myself, but actually, I don't think it's a bit. I mean, like, I seriously think we're in trouble here, folks, and there's a chance the Leafs could win the Cup this year. Like, it's not great for those of us who have enjoyed the schadenfreude of no Cups since 1967. I mean, like, they're talented. They've yet to have a moment in these playoffs where their psyche has been broken, which is usually when they're eliminated. And they might have the guy behind the bench in Craig Berube who's, you know, has some proof of concept vis-a-vis keeping his team focused and shutting out the outside noise with what he did in St. Louis. So I'm a little concerned. Like, if they can get past Florida, I think they beat whoever comes out of the Metro. And then, you know, we'll see what happens with the Western Conference with Dallas and Edmonton. But, like, it's a little disconcerting right now that this could be the Leafs' year.
Yeah, they have really changed. It's been a storyline if people have been following them. I'm sure some people in our audience have been all season long. Like, style-wise, how they played. Even came up watching, I think, one of the games in the Ottawa series that Buchogras and Weeks were doing. John was saying, like, yeah, there's just not a lot of offense from Toronto tonight. And I'm thinking to myself, this is how they've been mostly all year. Like, they've got the star power. So you know they can still do it, like, just on a dime, bang, just boat race you. But mostly they've been playing, I think they've been learning how to play all year, and now it's coming home to roost for them.
Yeah, they're fundamentally sound defensively. They've got good goaltending finally this year with Stolarz when he's healthy and with Wall, who was pretty good last night, or as good as he needed to be. But, you know, you also have some guys that, for all the criticism that the core four has gotten for not performing in the playoffs. I think Nylander's been insane. Maybe the second most valuable player in the playoffs behind Mikko Rantanen at this point. And Marner's gotten his points. Still waiting on Austin Matthews to announce his attendance in the proceedings, but that's fine. But they're good. And they're also tough. I mean, there's a certain toughness to this team to withstand what Ottawa was throwing at them, to withstand what Florida can throw at them. Obviously, Florida's already cost them their goaltender with what Sam Bennett did in game one. They're tough. They can push back, and also they're not dumb. They didn't do dumb things last night in trying to exact revenge for what the Panthers did in game one, which is usually what happens when you play the Panthers, but the Leafs didn't take the bait.
Yeah, very different. Yeah, Ekman Larson and McCabe on the back, and Tanev too. I was worried when they signed him that he would, you know, be on one leg by the time the playoffs got here, but they managed to get through that season, and he's still there. The guy that really, to me, is a piece that these Leafs have never had through this window is Nyes. To me, like, he is just such a different sort of player than any of the core group, and I feel like just adds an element there. Like, he's going to be a problem, I think, for years if you're interested in the Atlantic Division like we are in Buffalo.
For sure. And the other part about him too is he's young, so he doesn't carry the burden of, you know, a dozen seasons of playoff disappointments and get the blame for it and have the media on him all the time asking him why he can't win. I mean, he's also, like, new to the proceedings still in some ways. So they're quite good. I hesitate to put them over Florida because this Florida team could easily just put on the afterburners and take the series. But they've, in order to do that, you're going to have to plant the seed of doubt in the minds of the Maple Leafs that this isn't the year. And like I said, no one's been able to do that yet, even in the slightest. Even Ottawa couldn't do it despite pushing him to game six in the first round.
With Greg Wyszynski, Mike Schopen and the Bulldog here. So would, for you, or maybe even know a number, would the odds of a Canadian Cup be better than 50-50?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I had Dallas coming out of the West and winning the Cup, and as long as Mikko Rantanen is continuing to tally hat tricks every game, I feel pretty confident about that. But there's definitely, I mean, like, if I had to stake my life on it, right, I would say the Cup Finals, Edmonton and Toronto, in which case we don't have any escape. We're going to have the first Canadian Stanley Cup since 1993. But I mean, like,
it kind of feels like it might be headed there, you know, and then you get Matthews versus McDavid, you get the Leafs versus the Oilers, you have the Oilers trying to win the cup that they lost in game 7 last year and trying to, and we'll probably have all of Canada outside of Ontario behind them in trying to prevent the Leafs from winning. Like, it's a really, really compelling final, and it kind of feels like it might be heading there. The Oilers are playing really well, too. Like, I was super impressed with them defensively the last few games. Their depth is good. I still really like Dallas, especially if they can get Heiskanen back at some point. But, I mean, it kind of, you know, you can just take a deep breath. Go outside, smell it in the air, boys. It's Toronto-Edmonton.
Yeah. Yeah, Heiskanen, what is – do you have a guess there? I mean, it just feels like once he started taking morning skates, I thought, oh, it's got to be happening soon. And we got through the whole first round, and now we're a game into round two, and still no change. Is there any news on that front?
No, I mean, he's still working his way back. I mean, maybe you know, with some of the, you know, with the win in game one, they probably maybe can give him a little bit more time to work back. But I'm honestly shocked based on everything that we had heard and everything that they had been saying towards the end of the Colorado series that Robertson made it back before Heiskanen did. But you know, listen, they gutted out the Colorado series, which is extremely impressive when you consider what the Avalanche had on their roster and who was missing for Dallas. And then they go and do what they did in game one of the Winnipeg series. And so they can afford to be patient right now with their injured guys.
Checking the odds before, well, 2 days ago, the second round had started, but barely. I saw Dallas as the favorite by a little bit over Carolina. And Washington was the longest shot on the board at plus 1,000 to win it. And I wasn't expecting that, Greg. I mean, I saw game one and maybe that now I get it. But as someone who questioned Washington all year, like I was doing, they get the 5-game win in the first round. I did not expect the betting markets to show that Washington was like the biggest long shot, not by a tremendous amount. Thoughts on that matchup?
Well, I'm in D.C. now, hence the sirens, and I'm going to the game tonight. And I'm really intrigued to see what their counterpunch is going to be because that game one loss was the kind of loss that happens and has you questioning whether you can win a series. Now, their coach actually had to come out and say today before the game, we believe we can win the series and play our best hockey against Carolina. The simple fact that it needs to be addressed tells you what a humbling defeat it was in game one where the Caps couldn't get anything going. That being said, it's still the Hurricanes, which meant that it was a one goal game in overtime. You know, even when they're that dominant, even when they're that good, this is a team that constantly plays to the margins in the postseason and is in constant dire straits because they're winning games one, you know, by one goal and hoping that someone can find that goal. That's why they traded for Rantanen earlier this year. That's why they traded for Gensel last year. They're perpetually the team that has to hope somebody scores in a perfect situation to get them over the hump. So, again, it's not the most encouraging game one for Washington. The people that were heavy on Carolina are probably feeling pretty good about life right now. But at the end of the day, it was a one-bounce game.
Yep, right. Yeah, that is it. It would be fitting if Carolina were to go on some kind of a run here because this was the year I finally decided I'm done backing them in any way, shape, or form because it's just every year, it's just like they look like one of the best teams in the league, and then it's like, I don't know, Boston has their number for some reason or whatever it is. They just can't seem to get there. Do you think there's any fatigue there with front office, coach, anything? Like if the wheels were to come off of this thing, I mean, I imagine if they win a second round series that everyone is safe, but it feels to me like they've been, you know, this team for 5 or 6 years now.
Yeah, I mean, Eric Tolsky is their new GM. He took over for Don Waddell, so there's a little bit of new blood there. I mean, he was the assistant to Waddell, who's now in Columbus, but I mean, he's going to be given some time to kind of put his stamp on the roster. They took a big swing with Rantanen, and the fact that he, you know, didn't sign and they had to trade him again to Dallas, there might be some virtue in what they got back in Logan Stankoven, who's a good young player. But it still is kind of embarrassing to take that kind of swing and then not have the guy in the playoffs. And Brind'Amour, listen, he gets him to the playoffs every year. I don't think there's a lot of consternation about his role right now and his job right now. I think when he leaves, it'll be him deciding when to leave. But, you know, maybe it's the new Pope that has me feeling a little bit religious today.
Let's go.
you know, there are hockey gods. We know that. I mean, Buffalo fans know that more than anybody, that there's hockey gods.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe the hockey gods decree a Toronto-Edmonton final, or maybe they decree a Mikko Rantanen revenge tour of beating Colorado in the first round and then facing the Carolina Hurricanes in the Stanley Cup final. I mean, that could easily be what the hockey gods decree as well.
I only felt compelled to ask the question about Brind'Amour's future because the Sabres just hired Eric Staal as a special assistant to the GM. And, you know, just well, we get see how many 06 Hurricanes we can fit under one tent. It's
beautiful.
It's wild to me. Like, you guys are collecting them like Pokemon. Is Joe Corvo walking through that door anytime soon? Like, my God. I mean, but again, it's also like hockey nepotism, right? I mean, why is Eric Staal there? Eric Staal there is there because he played with Kevin Adams. We, you know, you guys mentioned on the update, why is Joel Quenneville in Anaheim? Because he was a teammate in Hartford in New Jersey with Pat Verbeek, their GM. You know, like it's always like this familial relationship, incestuous thing in the NHL. So I'm not surprised that Kevin is surrounding himself with some former teammates up there.
Saying that, the Sabres in this interminable playoff drought have gone, if you will, outside the box, not always in a good way, but, you know, first-time GMs and coaches, not first-time coaches in Kruger's case, but still a little bit of a different hire, and then Granato, too. What's left to say, Greg? I mean, 14 years, you know, no one of these names that we see bounce around running franchises all the time, the guys, the Waddells that get the next job the day after just because, I don't know, there's some credibility there or something. The Sabres seem to just, they can't be bothered to make a move like that up top.
I mean, is Botterill's got to be one of the few guys. I mean, I guess Bylsma too, like that got rehired after not working out in Buffalo. Like a lot of these guys haven't gotten another job.
And it took many years for both guys to get top jobs again.
It did. I don't know. I've in thinking about the Sabres, like I think it's pretty clear that they might be at the point where they need to start packaging some of these younger guys that they've been waiting on together to go and get guys that are maybe in their mid-20s that are a little bit closer to their prime. I mean, you know, I know Elias Pettersson's name has come up a bunch with the Canucks looking to maybe move him, but who knows? You'd be buying extremely low on him, and he's, you know, not the same player that he was a couple of years ago. But, you know, that's one path that it could take, and then it ultimately comes down to whether or not you have the faith that their front office is the right one to make those kinds of moves, because once you do start packaging young guys and sending young players out the door, as every Sabres fan knows, it could come back to haunt you in a pretty severe way. So that's the trick, and you know, they're in a pickle right now.
No kidding. It can come back to haunt us. I mean, it's not even believable the way we watched the Sabres trade players who went and won the Conn Smythe or won cups immediately just over and over. It's happened. Josh Norris is hopefully not the next example of a trade gone wrong, but he only played two games here. He was injured.
Three, maybe, yeah.
Maybe three.
Yeah.
Would Norris from Ottawa not have been available? Would he have been available if not for the injury history?
Potentially. I mean, you know, like Cousins is younger. I think he's got a bit of a different skill set. He's you know, controllable contract-wise, too. So there were still, you know, reasons to make that deal outside of the frustration with him being unable to stay healthy. But, I mean, obviously, like, the fact that they're looking for a bit more stability and they're looking for a guy to stay in the lineup certainly factored into their decision. I like him as a player. I'm kind of bummed that he can't stay healthy because I do think that he's actually a pretty solid offensive player and a good hand to have in the middle. But again, you know, the concern was health. And then he played, like you said, like what, two games? So, I mean, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point.
Yeah, it sure is. So how about like the overall here, Greg? It's been a pretty incredible year for the league with the success of the Four Nations Face-Off. I feel like these playoffs with the Game 7s we just had over the weekend that were just, I mean, great theater. I feel like the league is maybe riding as high as it ever has been. I wonder how much they would be fearing an all-Canadian Stanley Cup final like you were talking about a few minutes ago.
So, I mean, there's good and bad, right? I mean, Four Nations was a massive success to the point where now they're rethinking their international calendar and what they're going to do with the All-Star game. And I think that's probably right, even though I do think that the conditions were very specific to this year. geopolitically as to why that thing popped off the way it did. You know, they've got a collection of young stars. Scoring has been over 6 goals per game for the last few seasons. Power play has clicked in a way they hadn't clicked since the middle of the 1980s. There's a lot of things that are going right, and I think next year's Olympic tournament's going to be even, you know, a bigger boom, because I think the Americans have a legit shot at winning gold. But, you know, the Canadian part of your question is an interesting one, because while those games will be awesome and the atmospheres will be awesome, and I do think a lot of American fans really enjoyed watching the atmosphere in Edmonton and really enjoy watching the atmosphere in Winnipeg, for example, and kind of get that almost like college football vibe from how much the community cares about these things.
Yes.
It is tough for this league to really thrive without the Rangers, without the Bruins, without the Penguins, without the Flyers, without the Blackhawks, without the Red Wings, without all of the teams that kind of 2X the audience when they're contending. And so that's kind of the downside right now, is that we have a lot of really good teams and a lot of really good players and some amazing hockey, and they're not necessarily the franchises that the casual fan wants to watch.
Interesting. I mean, I'm very much with this group. I get bored by those other teams, you know, the New York, Philadelphia stuff. I'm glad to not have it. I'm a Hockey Night in Canada kid, though. I look forward to those ratings lists when they come out, the top 10 cities for viewership, because Buffalo's always on it. And so is so is Providence. And one, is it West Palm? There's one city in Florida that's always on the top 10.
It's West Palm. It's all the snowbirds and New Yorkers that migrated down there so they could buy McMansions. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the real tragedies of the way that Sabres have gone for the last, you know, over a decade, is when that team is competitive and when it pops, we know what the audience is going to be, not only locally, but all the same people that flood bars on Sundays to watch the Bills in cities across the country are all of a sudden going to be repping the Sabres if that team ever becomes relevant again. And it's something the league has certainly missed.
Well said. I like the college football comp too. I mean, it works. I'm thinking about the people outside
the
Leafs arena and so on.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So you mentioned you're in Washington. Where can we find you on the streaming / or just like social media? Because I don't want to make any mistakes here.
I'll be sucking down Guinnesses at the Irish Channel after the game. Oh, you mean like online?
Yeah, like during the game. Sorry.
You can read my stuff at ESPN.com as per usual, and pithy comments at Wyshynski on Twitter. I should also mention my friend Jeff Merrick. And I are doing our podcast again every Tuesday on dailyfaceoff.com, the Merrick versus Wyshynski podcast every Tuesday.
It's back.
It's on YouTube, so you can watch two subtly aging hockey pundits, one of whom combs his hair, me. The other one, I don't know what's going on, but we do our show every Tuesday now, and it's great.
What is the status of Mise en Pod?
Oh, my God, it's still thriving. Me and my wife, Ruby, do Mise en Pod. It's a food TV podcast on the Puck Soup Patreon, if you're interested in food TV, or more specifically in Top Chef, because we do the podcast every week during Top Chef. We just did the top 5 and 5 worst Restaurant Wars pop-up names of all time, a bonus episode. Big fan of Kentucky's Third Coast. I mean, think about it. We've got two coasts. The Low Country, where you get crawdaddies, that's the Third Coast. So, yeah, that's the podcast I like to do the most, because it's just me and my wife sitting across the kitchen table having a beer talking about Top Chef.
I like it this year. Toronto, speaking of Toronto, it's the first time I think they ever went to a restaurant I've been to when they went to Ravine Vineyards, Niagara-on-the-Lake. It's like 15 minutes from home.
Yeah. Oh, and it was gorgeous there, too. What's really funny is that they labeled the season Destination Canada, and they've yet to leave Toronto in about 8 episodes so far. So it's actually quite appropriate when you talk to people around Canada that get pissed off about how Toronto considers itself to be the center of the universe. The fact that Top Chef is doing Destination Canada but hasn't left a 3-block radius of Toronto, I think, is appropriate.
I would look forward to hearing you on one of these podcasts talk about your favorite or least favorite contestants. I've decided Kristen Kish, who is now the host of the show, is, I think, my favorite all-time contestant on the show, too. I don't think the show really misses Padma. I thought she was great, but I love the current host.
She was awesome. I'm a big fan of Buddha, who was on last season, because he was like a fan of the show that studied how to win, like, scientifically, and bought like 200 different molds for like making gelatin and stuff. And anyone who's a big fan of the show and also has broken the thing down into what Jeopardy contestants do to try to, like, you know, rig the board and everything, like, to have that now on Top Chef is really impressive.
Right. Well, we're going to have to, at some point, you get up this way, Maddie Matheson's place in Ridgeway, Ontario, which is just about a 20-minute jaunt over the Peace Bridge, Rizzo's House of Parm, has been getting a lot of love, and, you know, it's a tough table, but I think, we got to try to make something happen for you.
Oh, all right. Well, now you've got my attention. Anything, any favors to be called in
by media
moguls in the Buffalo area, I have to pay attention.
Let's please not start 9-14-1 next year, please.
Right. You have a reason to come here at some point.
Let's get it off the ground.
Right.
Greg, enjoy your night in Washington. Thanks as always.
Anytime. Thanks.
Greg Wyshynski on the Wester Hotline. First game tonight is Carolina at Washington. All right. 803-0550 to join us. We did some Bill stuff with the schedule, took a call on Keon Coleman. You know, we're post-draft here now. And
I schedule's next week. And I misidentified our guest on television last night.
Well, he was a great sport about it. He didn't seem to mind.
I'm tempted to retweet the picture that is on his Twitter feed to, like, put it to it. Like, do you think this is Greg Wyshynski? Because I feel like such a dolt.
You're thinking maybe it still was.
No,
Now you believe him.
No, I definitely believe him.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think you should.
It really, at least he admitted that the guy does look similar enough to him.
Yeah. So. We'll be back after the update. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog, WGR.
Baseball is back. The 2025 MLB season is upon us. So what's the easiest way to keep up with all the big stars, top scores, and fun storylines from the night before? What's the solution? Is there a secret?
Chocolate milk and squats. That's the secret.
Not quite, Pete, but there is the Morning Lineup podcast, a quick, less than 10-minute morning highlight show from MLB. It airs Mondays through Fridays on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You bring the chocolate milk, we'll bring the baseball news.